What would President Trump do? This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. As President Donald Trump says he would not automatically defend a fellow NATO country under attack. We called up the leader of Estonia to ask him about that.
The principle of NATO is if you attack us anywhere, we will get back to you everywhere.
Also, Trump has said some derogatory things about China, but apparently many Chinese prefer him to Hillary Clinton.
China sees Trump more of a businessman, which means they can strike a deal with Mr. Trump.
And in Nigeria, Trump's campaign seems familiar.
Trump is very like the kind of leaders we have here. They say what they feel like. They don't care what anybody's thinking. They just do their thing.
What a Trump presidency might look like today on The World. Donald Trump gives his big speech at the Republican National Convention tonight. So for the next hour, we're taking a hard look at what a Trump presidency could mean for a number of major foreign policy challenges, like the Middle East and climate change. But I want to start with controversial statements Trump has been making about NATO, the Western Military Alliance.
Many countries are not paying their fair share. That means we are protecting them and they are getting all sorts of military protection and other things. And they're ripping off the United States, and they're ripping you off.
Trump has also sparked concern in the Baltic states, NATO members Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. He suggested he might not come to their defense if Russia were to attack them. We got reaction directly from one of the Baltic leaders, Estonian President Tomas Ilves.
Sometimes I understand the concern that there are many countries that have not been paying as much as they have committed to. Already in 2011, Hillary Clinton published a long article in Foreign Policy about the same issue. So it's not as if it's a new issue. I mean, what we see is virtually all allies are increasing their defense expenditures. But in our case, I suppose we shouldn't have to worry because we have been paying our fair share. And moreover, we have been in Afghanistan, in one of the worst parts of Afghanistan, smack in the middle of Taliban territory in Helmand Province. So we have been loyal, committed NATO allies, and we believe in doing our share.
Mr. President, Donald Trump has also said that he would have to decide whether to come to the aid of NATO countries if they were attacked by Russia. What do you think about that?
The NATO treaty says that if one member of the alliance is attacked, then it is an attack on all of the alliance. And that has been the principle of NATO ever since 1949 when it was established.
Yeah, but if Donald Trump says he might not actually come to a NATO member's defense, what does that do to Estonia? What kind of position does that put you in?
Well, I don't think it really does anything more to Estonia than anyone else. It's simply the end of NATO. As soon as this treaty is abrogated, then at that moment, the alliance ceases to exist.
Doesn't the prospect of NATO ending concern you?
Of course. It concerns, I think, all NATO has a total population of 900 million people. I think it concerns everyone.
Estonia has just 5,000 active duty soldiers. Do you view Russia as a real military threat?
Well, if you have 30 divisions placed along the western border of the country and you see the behavior of what is especially the last 2 years in Ukraine, then yes, let's face it, there have been two countries that have been invaded since 2008 by Russia. I mean, Georgia was invaded and territory annexed there, and with an invasion of Ukraine, and the Crimea was annexed there. So all of NATO thinks this way.
You say all of NATO, you believe, feels that way.
We just had a summit in which everyone agreed to increase deterrence.
Mr. President, final question. Do you believe the United States still has the moral authority to lead the world?
Well, I certainly believe so. Without the moral authority of the United States, Eastern Europe today probably would not be the free area that it is. So I think that is something that is long-lasting.
Tomas Hendrik Ilves is president of Estonia. Really appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Let's turn to Turkey now, where a state of emergency has been declared after last week's attempted military coup. But even before that, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan had started cracking down on his opponents, arresting thousands of people accused of being sympathetic to the failed coup. GOP nominee Donald Trump told the New York Times that he was glad Erdogan had, quote, turned things around, end quote, and also that he would not criticize Turkey for cracking down on dissent after the coup. The world's Richard Hall is in Istanbul. So what's been the reaction in Turkey to Trump's statements, Rich?
There hasn't been one as far as I can see, because they're kind of busy with their own problems at the moment. But I'd imagine Erdogan would be very, very happy with what Donald Trump said. Other people, not so much. We might want to look at his statement that he gave while the coup was ongoing. He was asked about the situation in Turkey, and his response was kind of the response you'd see on an aunt's Facebook page, an aunt that had recently gone to Turkey. He said, "I've got so many friends in Turkey, a lot of anguish last night, but hopefully it will all work out." There was no policy, there was no plan, there was no what I would do to fix the situation. And I think the problem with Donald Trump's Turkey policy is the same problem that he has with his whole Middle East policy, is that he probably can't find many of these places on a map. I'm sure he could find Turkey on a map, but his policies are based on not knowing too much about the situation and muddling through, I think.
Although a lot of people would say, well, that's why they have advisors, right?
Yeah, I mean, as I understand it, he's due to get security briefings next week, and they probably can't come soon enough.
What about elsewhere in the Middle East in the fight against ISIS, the Islamic State? What do you make of the aggressive tone coming from Donald Trump?
Well, it's really interesting, actually. Donald Trump's Syria policy. As we know, Obama's come under some criticism for his Syria policy. And one of the main reasons for that is that he hasn't been seen to be taking a strong enough line with Assad. There's also been some criticism that Obama's bombing campaign against ISIS has killed civilians. Donald Trump seemingly wants to double down on both of those policies. So he criticizes Obama for not being strong enough in Syria, but he also wants to essentially double down on the policies that people criticize Obama for in Syria. And there's also the question of Assad. Donald Trump essentially said he wants to leave Assad alone and concentrate on ISIS. Now, if you speak to most experts and former U.S. diplomats, they're pretty outspoken about this. They say that the reason ISIS continues to gain recruits is because of the brutality of Assad, and one can't be solved without the other. So he's kind of making the same mistakes Obama's done.
So here is Donald Trump, for example, on the campaign trail in Iowa, declaring that he'd destroy ISIS by destroying their oil facilities.
I would bomb the shit out of them. I would just bomb those suckers. And that's right. I'd blow up the pipes. I'd blow up the refinery. I'd blow up every single inch. There would be nothing left. And I'd take the oil.
All right. Well, that's the kind of temperament we are used to with Donald Trump. Is that the temperament for Mideast diplomacy?
I don't think so. I mean, in that sense, he has something in common with the rulers of this region, or the former rulers of this region, that he portrays himself as a strong man. But the Middle East is a very complicated place, as the listeners probably realize. It takes a lot of nuance and a depth of knowledge that Donald Trump doesn't seem to have. And I think if we go back to the Iraq war, when U.S. presidents have acted in this region with their gut and not with their clear-minded thinking, then things have tended to go wrong. And that's what many people in the Middle East seem to think about the U.S.
What about the anti-Muslim rhetoric that we're hearing from many Trump supporters and Republicans this week at the convention? What's been the reaction in the Arab-speaking world? And won't this fritter away any good relations the U.S. has with the rare loyal allies like Jordan?
I imagine it's going to create huge problems when it comes down to Donald Trump, if he does become president, sitting across the table from Middle Eastern leaders who are deeply religious people. Like you say, Jordan, we have Erdogan is another example. He's a religious man. And Donald Trump's made these heinous remarks about Muslim people that these leaders will find deeply offensive. So it's hard to see how they're going to sit down at the same table and have great relationships, as Donald Trump continues to claim he will have. And whenever I've spoken to people here about Donald Trump's comments about Muslims, it's disbelief, it's disgust. That's the same across the region.
The world's Richard Hall in Istanbul. Rich, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Let's move over to Africa now, more than 50 countries, a continent that Donald Trump has said should be recolonized because Africans are still under slavery. African leaders are all greedy and inhumane, he says. Adobe Trisha Nobani is a writer in Abuja, the Nigerian capital. Good to speak with you again, Adobe.
Thank you, Marco.
What do Nigerians think about the U.S. elections this year?
Of course, we find it very entertaining. You know, people are constantly talking about what's happening, laughing about the things we read and watch on TV. We've been bombarded with all the Trump media and everything else. So we found it very entertaining. And of course, you have some, you know, at least one very entertaining candidate. So people talk about it all the time.
Is there a serious thread to the discussions?
Well, there is, of course. I live in Abuja, which is in the north, and we have a number of Muslims here. So I know people are angry. Some people are angry about the things he says about Muslims and those kinds of comments he makes. Of course, he says things about Nigeria and Africa as well.
What about the comment that I mentioned a moment ago, that Africa should be recolonized because Africans are still under slavery and that African leaders are all greedy and inhumane? I'm sure a number of Nigerians would probably agree with that.
Well, yes. The thing about Trump is saying things that nobody has said before. It's just so strange to hear someone who hopes to occupy such a high position, the president of the United States, saying these things that typically are said by not that kind of person. I mean, you hear those things all the time. People make those kinds of derogatory comments about the way things are run in Africa. We make fun of ourselves sometimes, but it's just so strange to hear a U.S. presidential candidate saying those things.
Well, here's a clip of The Daily Show's Trevor Noah comparing Donald Trump to one African president in particular.
Trump is so African presidential, he's already at the level of Zimbabwe's president, Robert Mugabe, whose brutality and repressive tactics have kept him in power for 35 years.
My people have great praise for me.
People love me. Everybody loves me.
The little man.
He's very low energy.
Land is ours. It's not European. It's our land. And we have taken it.
We'll take our country back.
We will win. We will be winning all the time.
We will have so much winning if I get elected that you may get bored with winning.
Okay. Trevor Noah doing what he does best on The Daily Show. We're not saying Trump would be a brutal dictator, but would Nigerians agree with that comparison, the Trump-Mugabe comparison?
Trump is very like the kind of leaders we have here. They say what they feel like. They don't care what anybody's thinking. They just do their thing. They believe in themselves and they have their followership and they just don't care what anybody else thinks. So we're used to that kind of leaders. But we have a more, for want of a better word, interesting characters here who contest and who are in power, who say funny things, who do ridiculous things all the time and get away with it. Just yesterday, there were protests to the National Assembly here in Nigeria because of a male senator who allegedly threatened a female colleague by telling her, "I'm going to beat you up and I'm going to get you pregnant."
Wow.
Now, that's the kind of thing we hear. This is a conversation happening in the Senate. It's not happening in the market.
Wow.
But then here's Donald Trump saying things that, like I said, we hear all the time, strange things. But it's just so odd to hear an American presidential candidate saying those kinds of things.
Something I've noticed over the years about Nigeria, it seems to have borrowed quite liberally from the American political system. It's a federal republic. Mm-hmm. You have a federal capital and regional states with some of their own legal power to govern. And you essentially have a two-party system. Do Nigerians look at the political disunity and kind of unpredictability in the U.S. right now and wonder, did we emulate the wrong country?
It's just a bit confusing. We're just not used to seeing the U.S. in this kind of state. The U.S. seems to have had everything under control over time. That's the way people perceive the U.S. So now, with all the uncertainty and the strange things happening, people are a bit unsure. I don't think we've got to the point where we're saying, did we copy the wrong thing? No. We just think things are changing all over the world. And then with all the threats, the new threats the world is facing. So it's just a bit odd. Nigerians are big fans of U.S. politics. We follow everything. People know exactly what's happening. People even have their favorite candidates and say who they would vote for if they were Americans and able to vote. But it's just still so confusing the way things are happening now, you know. We'll just have to wait till November and see.
Adobe Trishan Obani, a writer in Abuja, Nigeria. Thank you very much for your thoughts, as always.
Thank you very much, Malcolm.
You're with the world. Donald Trump will face a number of foreign policy challenges if he makes it to the White House. We've already discussed today Trump's views on the NATO alliance and the Middle East. In a moment, we'll hear about ongoing reaction in Mexico to Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric. First, though, an update on the protests brewing in Mexico for more than 2 months. Trouble began in the southern Mexican state of Oaxaca as a labor dispute between a teachers' union and the state government. But it is a national dispute, too, over a controversial education reform bill passed by Mexico's federal government. About a month ago, police in Oaxaca opened fire on protesters who had blocked a highway. At least 8 people were killed. Reporter Shannon Young lives in Oaxaca and is following the story.
When the killings happened, the federal police commander came out and said, well, the agents weren't even armed, not even with riot batons. And when faced with photographic and video evidence to the contrary, there was a claim that the photos were fake. Only after international media organizations like the Associated Press offered to share their metadata to prove the authenticity of the photos was there an additional backpedal, and the official version of events was changed to, yes, police were armed, but they were responding to an ambush.
So let's get behind the dispute over the reform bill. What's it really about? Are we talking education and the way children are taught in Oaxaca and Mexico, or is it really more political?
The teachers themselves, especially the teachers with the CENTE, the dissident wing of Mexico's teachers union, have said this is really more about a labor and administrative reform rather than about education in general or in the way that children are taught. So if the goal is to change the education system, why not start with the actual lesson plans and the criteria and the curriculum rather than prohibiting teachers from going on strike or tying their job security to standardized tests?
Some of that dispute sounds a lot like themes here in American education: teacher accountability, standardized testing, unions, strong or weak. I mean, do you see that too?
Yes, yes. And I think that when people are trying to understand the full implications of where this could go in the future, they can look at the U.S. and see what has happened, for example, with, you know, not only the weakening of unions, but the charterization of public schools, or making it to where the poorest public schools end up getting stuck in a cycle of having their schools shut down due to low performance. And then that, you know, leads to overcrowding. It's kind of seen as a omen, if you will, of what could happen in the schools here in Mexico. And I think that that's probably why teachers in the poorest states are pushing back against this the hardest.
Speaking of looking at the U.S., Shannon, with tonight's acceptance speech by Republican nominee Donald Trump, a man who's called Mexicans rapists and criminals and wants Mexico to pay for a construction of a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border, how is Trump's nomination being received down in Oaxaca?
I don't really get the sense that people here are hanging on Donald Trump's every word, you know, getting ready to react to his acceptance speech. But there's more of a general air of horrified disbelief that a person who has used such blatantly offensive rhetoric with regards to Mexicans and made building this border wall such a central part of his campaign has actually gone on to become the GOP candidate. I'll get questions from friends and acquaintances of, you know, is this really happening? Do you think that this man will actually become the president? You know, I think people are kind of just watching with clenched teeth and hoping that their neighbors don't vote for somebody who has been so openly hateful of Mexico and Mexicans.
Reporter Shannon Young in Oaxaca, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
If Trump does get elected president, here's another challenge he could be facing not too far from home: sorting out what to do with the Guantanamo Bay detention facility in Cuba. Here's candidate Trump on that topic in February.
This morning, I watched President Obama talking about Gitmo, right? Guantanamo Bay, which, by the way, we are keeping open. And we're going to load it up with some bad dudes, believe me. We're going to load it up.
Arun Roth with our partners at WGBH is at Guantanamo this week, where the war court is back in session. Arun, Donald Trump has promised to reverse any decision to close a prison at Guantanamo and, as he puts it, load it up with bad dudes if he makes his way to the White House. So how doable would all that be?
Well, if Donald Trump becomes the commander-in-chief, that would be very doable. With all the releases that have been happening, the transfers that have been happening over the last several months, there would be room here. And I know the folks here, if they were ordered by their commander-in-chief to ramp it up, make more space, and allow more prisoners, that could certainly happen.
So, Arun, catch us up with what's been happening in the 9/11 war court this week.
I was going to say it's been a strange week, but I feel like I always say that to you every time that we talk. The week started with a closed-door session, which lasted only 21 minutes. We don't know what that was about because it was discussing a sealed motion that had been submitted the day before. Then there was one day with no court. Yesterday just met for less than 3 hours altogether, discussing whether or not the defendant, Walid bin Attash, has the right to defend himself or fire his attorneys. He was told by the judge he can do one of two things. He can keep the team he has or act as his own counsel or represent himself. We're waiting that decision right now. We also had a very contentious back and forth today over a motion from the defense asking the judge and prosecution to recuse themselves. The defense says that they destroyed evidence that they need, but we had both sides using the word despicable to describe the other. It got pretty nasty.
Also this week, another big piece of news from Gitmo, one of the most famous prisoners, Mohamedou Slahi, who wrote the Guantanamo Diary, has been cleared for release. I remember having his lawyers on the show. It took him 6 years to get permission to publish his book, and that was after U.S. censors made over 2,000 cuts to the text.
Yeah, we finally heard the results of what they call the Periodic Review Board, and they gave him sort of a glowing report as being a good prisoner with excellent prospects. So we may, once he's out, maybe we can find out what's in those parts that were left out.
So many Gitmo prisoners have been transferred in the last several months or cleared for release, like Slahi. Where does this leave us in terms of President Obama's desire to close the prison at Guantanamo?
The pace has picked up on these transfers. These periodic review boards are happening. But this keeps boiling us down to this essential problem we have, because we're going back to these guys that are on trial and also the ones who have not been charged but are also considered too dangerous to release. We're talking about roughly 40 people who can't be transferred or released because of the restrictions that have been placed on President Obama by Congress. He cannot, as of now, bring them to a prison in the U.S. So these military commissions, Marco, are not going to be wrapped up anytime soon. So I would just have to say that in terms of the prospect for closing the prison here, that just doesn't seem possible that that's going to happen before the next president would take office.
You know, Guantanamo has been such a serious and contentious issue as long as it's been a detention facility. I have to ask you something that's not serious, though some people treat it as such. Pokemon Go, has it really reached Gitmo? Did I see those headlines correctly?
You saw the headlines, and you can actually look at my tweets, because, Marco, I'm actually not a big fan of mobile gaming, but I heard the report, so I decided to give it a go myself, loaded it, and I have caught a Bulbasaur and a Charmeleon. I caught one in the officers' club, and I caught one at the local Irish bar, which I don't know if you know that Guantanamo has an Irish pub here, but whether there are any on the other side of the wire, I will not be able to investigate that on this trip at least.
Reporter Arun Roth speaking with us from Camp Justice, the legal complex at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Arun, thank you.
Thanks, Marco. Always a pleasure.
Later on the show, how many people in China feel about Donald Trump. It may surprise you. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Donald Trump says he would tear up the Paris Climate Treaty. He's called climate change a hoax. But not all Republicans feel that way.
We're courting disaster. We're basically pulling defeat down upon us by taking on this retro affect that says that climate change isn't real.
That's still to come here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Tonight, Donald Trump officially accepts the Republican presidential nomination. Just a few months ago, many people thought that would never actually happen. But Trump has proved the doubters wrong at every step of this campaign season. Throughout the show today, we're taking a closer look at several big challenges Trump could face as president. For example, the GOP nominee has promised to tear up, renegotiate, or reinterpret a long list of international agreements if he's elected president. Somewhere near the top of that list, last year's global climate deal.
We're going to cancel the Paris Climate Agreement and stop. Unbelievable.
That's Trump a couple of months ago on the campaign trail in North Dakota. The Republican presidential nominee has made his contempt for the science of climate change clear for years. He's called it a hoax, a con job, and a word we can't say on the radio, but he did say it in a tweet. Now, we know that the new Republican presidential nominee is out of step with much of his party on many issues, But on climate change, he's solidly in the GOP mainstream. There are Republicans who take Trump to task on this issue, though. One of them is former South Carolina Representative Bob Inglis. Mr. Inglis is not in Cleveland this week, and he's not on board with his party's dismissal of the reality of climate change. Mr. Inglis, why do you think your fellow Republicans and Mr. Trump have so forcefully rejected climate science?
Well, I think it's mostly they don't like the solution. They assume that solution is a bigger government. But at republicen.org, we live to show them that there's a small government solution that's really based in free enterprise.
So Republican, that's republic-en, en as in energy and enterprise. And you believe there are some strong conservative approaches to solving the climate challenge. What are some of the actual tools that Republicans could and should embrace?
Well, it really is essential to ask the question the right way. You know, people ask if we believe in climate change, and we say, no, we don't believe. It's not worthy of belief. It's just data. But the better way to ask it, I suppose, is can free enterprise solve climate change? And we think the answer to that question is most certainly yes. What we have here is a problem of economics that has an environmental consequence. And so if we fix the economics, which actually is acceptable to many people on the left and on the right, we can bring America together and solve this problem and in the process make some money while we're serving customers with better energy sources around the world. So it's an incredible opportunity that just needs a little touch of government to make everyone accountable for their emissions. And that would be, of course, a revenue-neutral, border-adjustable carbon tax. And then the government can step back and watch free enterprise fix the problem.
Things like a carbon tax have been total non-starters among Republicans and even some Democrats in Congress. Meantime, Donald Trump and your party's new platform have taken a strongly pro-coal position when coal is the biggest offender when it comes to climate pollution. Why did you not go to Cleveland this week to press your case?
Well, I think what we're seeing in Cleveland is the death gasp of the grumpy old party. And aligning itself with coal is that industry, which has lost 95% of its market capitalization since 2011, is surely yet another sign of the death gasp. So we are hoping for the birth of the Grand Opportunity Party. It's a very different place that says, yeah, we can do this.
So where do Republicans like yourself, Bob Inglis, go? You know, you take the threat of climate change seriously. I mean, Hillary Clinton's taken a strong position. You're going to vote for her? You're going to vote for Jill Stein, Green Party candidate?
It's very difficult because, it's impossible for me to vote for Donald Trump, of course, because, it's just antithetical to everything that I believe as a conservative.
So who are you going to vote for?
I don't know yet. It's really difficult.
So whoever you're going to vote for, do you think the position of Donald Trump and the GOP on climate change this year will affect your party's showing in November?
Yes, I think that we're courting disaster. We're basically pulling defeat down upon us by taking on this retro affect that says that climate change isn't real. I mean, it's just out of step with where the science is and where the smart money is. You know, politics is a trailing indicator. The smart money is already moving to act on climate.
Do you think in some illogical way your Republican colleagues are holding to this platform because they have to distinguish themselves somehow from the Democrats?
Well, yeah, and I think a better way to distinguish ourselves is to say we don't like the solution of the Clean Power Plan. It's a regulatory, domestic-only, prone-to-litigation solution. But we got a better solution. And so rather than shrinking in science denial because we don't like the solution, I think we should step forward with an exciting solution, and it would be built on the free enterprise solution that conservatives can really support on climate change.
Former South Carolina Representative Bob Inglis, the founder of Republican, thank you.
Great to be with you, Margo.
So that's one take on Trump and climate change. It's not unrelated to commerce. The more stuff we make and distribute and sell, the more we pollute. So let's turn our attention to Trump and trade. Here's a bit from the Trump campaign website.
Some people have said that my policies on trade will lead to a trade war. Well, I guess when you think about it, we're already in one. We're losing $500 billion a year to China. We're losing billions and billions to Japan and Vietnam and India. And Mexico is beating us both at the border and they're beating us in trade.
For many of us, it's hard to make sense of campaign rhetoric and sound bites about complex trade topics. The World's Jason Margolis is on the economics beat for us this campaign season. Jason, first of all, what is Trump's plan on trade?
Well, Trump has a few major policy positions, and let's start with NAFTA. That's the North American Free Trade Agreement, which allows goods to flow freely between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. And just to remind you, that came into effect in 1994. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's controversial, but we'll save that story for another day. Trump says he would renegotiate NAFTA and impose a 35% tariff. That's a fancy word for a tax on imports. And he would do that on Mexico. And then there's China. Trump says he would impose a 45% tariff on Chinese imports.
All right, break that down. What does that mean?
Okay, so let's say you buy a refrigerator from Mexico. Just for simplicity, let's say the refrigerator costs $100. Under Trump's plan, that refrigerator from Mexico now has a 35% tariff. So the refrigerator now costs $135, right? Mm-hmm. So the thinking behind the tax is that an American consumer would then go to the store and gravitate toward an American refrigerator because now it's cheaper than the Mexican one. Now, here's the problem. Mexico is going to retaliate. And our products going into Mexico are going to be slapped with a Mexican tariff. And then you have a trade war.
Right. So can a president just unilaterally change trade deals like NAFTA?
The short answer is no. A president needs congressional approval to do that. And that might be a very tough sell because Republican Party leaders Mitch McConnell in the Senate and Paul Ryan in the House, they're both big proponents of more free trade. And if the Democrats take control of the Senate, well, then it would make it even harder for a President Trump. But a president technically could simply withdraw from a treaty like NAFTA without Congress. But it's never happened, and it would almost certainly be challenged in the courts, and no one knows what would happen then.
So let's say a President Trump does what he says he will. What then?
Yeah. So I asked a bunch of economists about that. One of them is Lee Brandstetter at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. He told me, you want to know what would happen if a President Trump could pull away from trade deals and levy high tariffs on our trading partners? He says this happened before in the late 1920s.
As the Great Depression began, Republicans reacted to economic weakness with a plan to raise tariffs on thousands of goods to levels exceeding 60%. Economists opposed it, and Henry Ford denounced it as economic stupidity. Democrats were more pro-trade, and they opposed the bill. But President Herbert Hoover, desperate to ensure his own reelection and wanting to curry favor with workers who were increasingly worried about an economic slowdown, signed the bill in 1930. History tells us what happened next.
The Great Depression happened next. That was a long time ago, though, Jason. Is that model still relevant?
Yes, it's still very relevant, and economists study that. But if you want a more recent example, Brandstetter says look at the Brexit vote, where a majority of Brits voted to pull away from the European Union.
Even before Brexit legally started, the British stock market took an immediate hit, the pound fell sharply, and the chances of a British recession have risen. Trump is advocating a far more complete repudiation of globalization than Brexit. If he gets Congress to back him, or even if he looks like he's going to get Congress to back him, Trumponomics would be Brexit on steroids, and the economic consequences would be far more dramatic.
Wow. So you said you spoke with several economists, Jason. Do the others agree with Brandstetter?
They do. They all said Brandstetter has it right. But when I was talking to Brandstetter, I said, well, people might hear this and think you're just a liberal academic. Now, after all, he did serve in the Obama administration, and here was his response.
I'm not a political actor. I am an economist, and the positions that I've described are about as close to sort of a universal truth as you can ever get a set of economists to agree on.
And in fact, Marco, one of President George W. Bush's chief economic advisors told the New York Times recently that there are a few things economists are unanimous about, but support of free trade comes pretty close.
Well, there's some unity. The World's Jason Margolis on the Economics Beat. Thanks for telling us about this.
Oh, you're welcome.
Jason mentioned Donald Trump's proposal to raise tariffs on Chinese goods. Trump generally doesn't mince words when it comes to China. He's even said China has been, quote, raping the U.S. economically. So how does China feel about Trump? My colleague Vincent Nee is a reporter with BBC China. He's usually based in London, but he's in Cleveland this week covering the Republican National Convention.
Well, China has actually been quite calm to Mr. Trump's words. I mean, they don't agree with Mr. Trump's description of China, of course, but China also understands China bashing is a very unique American political phenomenon. Ever since Richard Nixon visited China in 1972, in every single American election, candidates will use China as a target when they are justifying their domestic and international policies. So China understands this quite well.
You've been meeting and speaking with Chinese Americans over the past few days at the convention in Cleveland. What have they been telling you?
Well, it's quite interesting. We have to remember this is a Republican National Convention, and essentially this is Mr. Trump's convention. And with among all these Chinese supporters that I met in this convention, they are basically telling me why they come to Cleveland from across the country. And there was also a bit of competition going on among all these thousands of members, Chinese members supporting Trump. They're basically telling me why Trump's policies will benefit Chinese communities rather than Hillary Clinton's policies.
Were you surprised to see that? I mean, Chinese Americans supporting Donald Trump?
Well, to some extent, I'm not really surprised because I have been covering why Chinese people, both inside China and outside China, support Mr. Trump. But this time, what really surprised me is the reasons why they support Trump. I sat down with a few Chinese Americans who support Trump, and they were basically telling me first thing they support Trump is really because Trump's education policy will probably be better for them. For example, you know, they don't like affirmative actions at all. They think their kids will be better off if the U.S. does not have affirmative action. And secondly, they were basically telling me Mr. Trump's tax policies and his economic policies will benefit those Chinese-American people who a lot of them have businesses in the United States.
Yeah, so kind of motivated by personal interest in their support for Trump. So, Vincent, what are you hearing from people in China about a possible Trump president? Because if somebody like Donald Trump is saying China is raping our country, I mean, doesn't that create all sorts of really sore feelings? How do they feel about Trump?
Well, I think it depends on who you are talking to. I think if you talk to ordinary Chinese people, I mean, also among ordinary Chinese people, there are very nationalistic Chinese people who absolutely would hate Donald Trump's words. But if you talk to rational Chinese people, they understand this is basically the American election politics. But I think for the Chinese government, they probably would prefer Donald Trump because Donald Trump has called for withdrawal of Americans' extended power in East Asia. Now, we have seen over the past few months that the South China Sea issue is really hitting China. And then if U.S. really is going to withdraw its extended power in the South China Sea or even East China Sea, China wouldn't be too unhappy about it. And in comparison, Hillary Clinton might be tougher to China if she becomes the president. That's certainly according to many columnists in China.
I don't know about Clinton, but at least on the Trump and South China Sea tip, I mean, I'm kind of surprised to hear that because there's always been concern that one false move in the South China Sea could provoke a war. And given the unpredictability of at least what Donald Trump says, I would think that Chinese would be worried about what a Trump presidency might mean for the South China Sea.
Well, yes. But on the other hand, China sees Trump more of a businessmen, which means they can strike a deal with Mr. Trump. And what's more important is Mr. Trump has also threatened U.S. longtime allies in East Asia, namely Japan and South Korea, say, if you don't pay us more, we are going to withdraw our extended power, our help in your countries. So these are really creating frictions among American allies. And, you know, when China is seeing what's happening between Mr. Trump and American allies in East Asia, China was thinking, if Donald Trump is really going to create a problem with its allies, this is probably a strategic time to move around, and because China is really in expansionary mode at the moment.
BBC China correspondent Vincent Ni speaking with us from Cleveland. By the way, The World's Patrick Nguyen has been doing some deep digging into U.S.-China tensions. He's written a story on how Beijing is even warning of a potential war with the U.S. Definitely worth a read at PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman with The World. All eyes and ears are on Donald Trump tonight as he accepts his nomination at the Republican National Convention. Expect a lot of cheers from Trump supporters in the audience. Political conventions can be rowdy affairs, but last night the RNC sounded more like a WWE SmackDown. Jeers for Texas Senator and failed presidential candidate Ted Cruz of Texas. Last night, the conventioners were upset Cruz did not endorse Trump, and they let Cruz have it. Okay, we know screaming and chanting are normal parts of political conventions, but hearing them on TV and hearing them live, two completely different things. And depending on the ears and perspectives, they take on various meanings. That's why we wanted to get the world's Leo Hornack and Maria Muriel to talk about these chants. They've been reporting for us all week in Cleveland, bringing their outsider point of view. And Maria, let me start with you. This chant here really got your attention. So why lock her up, referring to Clinton there? What did you think when you heard it?
The first thing I think about when I hear that is the fact that Hillary Clinton is a woman. It's quite an aggressive rally of the GOP uniting against the other candidate, which is expected, right? But for me, just noticing, wow, you know, this feels especially aggressive just because Hillary happens to be a woman. And this is, you know, there are a lot of great things about having a woman running for the highest office in our country. And there are also negatives, which is that some of these things just seem a little bit weird.
Well, especially in the context of one Trump supporter from New Hampshire saying Clinton should be put in front of a firing squad for Benghazi. I mean, it does feel especially aggressive, doesn't it?
It does.
Now, Leo, you were there last night when Ted Cruz got booed off the stage. Quite a moment. I mean, we heard it earlier, but so dramatic when these apparently unscripted moments happen. Here it is again. Leo, in the UK, I mean, we see this kind of behavior in the House of Commons when ministers are arguing, but at the party conference of conservatives, you ever see this kind of disunity?
Well, this is what was really interesting to me, is when I spoke to delegates on the floor, they reminded me very much of the kind of conservative party activists you would meet in the UK, similar opinions in many areas. But the actual atmosphere and these kind of chants and booing is something that you don't really see in Britain. And it's something that I kind of have struggled to get my head around in a way, because in Britain, most conservative activists are people who come from maybe small town areas. They have conservative values. They're generally not people who go out in public in fancy dress or who jump up in the stalls when they're at a cinema or something and start shouting at the screen. That would not be a particularly conservative thing to do. And so it's something that I think is really interesting, and there's a part of me that feels it's quite healthy and cathartic, maybe, but it is a strange contrast how the same people who you can speak to on the delegates you can speak to on the floor in the convention center at the Republican convention can be speaking to you about how they believe in small government and how they think that it's important to live quietly and live frugally. That can be the same person who can be jumping up and booing the stage and screaming their applause when they hear something that they agree with, or chanting USA, USA, USA. 5 minutes later, when you speak to them, calm, quiet, reserved again.
Not all of the yelling is negative, we should say. After several days of boos and lock her up, out comes this one. That is a chant, of course, for Republican vice presidential nominee Mike Pence. Maria, why'd this one stand out for you?
I thought it was kind of sweet, actually. It's obviously a throwback to I Like Ike, the Eisenhower years. And it was, for me, the first really positive and just a happy moment of the crowd rallying behind the person on stage in a very innocuous way, I thought. And it actually reminded me of when I was in Peru earlier this year during their presidential elections, and I witnessed a demonstration on the street of the two parties sort of marching toward each other. But they were really not hurling attacks at one another. They were just chanting support for their own candidate.
Finally, Maria and Leo, just for old time's sake, let's play a time-worn classic. Yeah, that one. If you could sum up the chants in one word, Leo and Maria, what would it be?
Well, for me, I think it would be contrast. And that's the contrast between what you experience on the floor in the convention center and what maybe you see if you're watching it at home. And when you see them on TV, I think some of these chants, like, you know, lock her up or USA, USA, USA. They have a kind of energy, but you're not seeing the context. You're not seeing the smiles that people have on the convention floor. You're not seeing people bumping into old friends. You don't get the warmth that you actually get in the convention center. I know that might sound a strange word to use when you're talking about lock her up, but there is a real feeling of camaraderie when you're among these delegates.
Maria, what about you?
I think my word would be surprising. I talked to this lovely older woman just outside the convention center after one of the nights, and she was just so shy and so excited to speak to a reporter. And it was so endearing to speak with her, and she was very nice and very quiet. And then that's just, as Leo's saying, that's such a huge contrast to being on the floor where, honestly, most of the times that I've been there, there's a point in the night where I get goosebumps from just the energy of these chants, whether it's positive or negative.
The World's Maria Muriel and Leo Hornack speaking with us about political chants heard at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Thanks a lot to you both.
Thank you, Marco.
Thanks, Marco.
Surprising. Yeah, that's definitely one word that comes to mind. We heard the president of Estonia today voice his concern about Donald Trump's surprising views on NATO. Trump says he might not actually come to a NATO member's defense if they were attacked. We heard the confusion in Nigeria about what the USA is lately. Maybe not the place it once was when Nigeria thought to emulate our federal system, but also how Donald Trump's rhetoric is mild compared to someone like Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe. And we heard the surprising note from China that many there might see Trump as someone who could be easier to deal with on security issues than Hillary Clinton. Obviously, this isn't the whole story, and we'll be getting another piece of the puzzle next week when Leo and Maria head to Philadelphia for the Democratic National Convention. Hey, what did Winston Churchill say? It has been said that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others that have been tried from time to time. With that in mind, here's a track from a new album I've been wanting to play for you. These are the psychedelic Brazilian rockers Nasal Zumbi with a reggae-inspired tune called Defeito Perfeito. Perfect defect. De perto, uma cor é outra, se chega inteiro. O defeito aparece, é bem diferente. Nada é como se quer. Nada. De perto, a cor é outra, se sente um cheiro. O defeito aparece, é bem diferente. Nada é como se espera. Nada não. Eu me quero. And that's our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with y'all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.